Yeah, we can get started. I mean, I've just missed this class. I don't think I'll be able to do like quite so long a break next time. It was too long. I really missed being here and everything. But yeah, quite an adventure during the break. Quite an adventure. But
do they know what little town you live in?
Yeah, no one knows anything about that. Like, everybody is just trying to figure out where Green Mountain Falls is, especially the guys from the competitions that were winning, and they're like, where is that even at? I mean, there's so much going on. It's so crazy. I don't know. God is awesome, and he's going to do some amazing stuff, and I'm just trying to hold on to the reins, basically. All three things are expanding at the same time. So, we'll see. But we are going to go into the second half of Genesis, and we get to Genesis 26 tonight. Genesis 26 is one of the most relatable. I mean, a lot of Genesis is kind of difficult to relate to and figure out, but this is one of the more relatable ones, especially like the last passage. I think we can most of us can relate to that. Well, we'll get into that. We'll get into Genesis 26. But first, let's pray. Heavenly Father, we welcome you to this place. Thank you so much for this chance to be together. Protect everyone here as they travel. Bless everyone that wants to be here and isn't here. Keep them safe on their travels. And bless our minds and our hearts. Open them up to hear your words, your way. It's all about you as we dive into the Word and continue our study of Genesis. We ask you to bless this place and be with us. Be in our hearts and minds, and you're welcome here. Thank you for your Word and the ability to study it and help us understand it deeper and deeper. We're so thankful for everything you do. And we pray these things in Jesus' name. Amen. So, Genesis 26, we continue our story of these patriarchs, right? And we're going to talk a little bit about Isaac, but the thing about Genesis 26 is it really has some pieces of it that are echoes and reflections of previous stuff. It has some pieces of it that are kind of like living life and how it works. And there's fascinating things that we're discovering here. And we get a series of clues about stuff. I'll give you an example. It starts off, there was a famine in the land. And then it says, besides the first famine in the days of Abraham. Now, why would it say that? And the reason is that famine in the days of Abraham that it's talking about was the big boy. That's the one we talked about, the 4.2 kill a year aridification event, blah, 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 bond event, right? That whole thing we talked about in length, that really created the fall of Egypt and entering into that intermediate period, as well as the fall of the Akkadian Empire. It freed Abraham up to travel. That thing lasted a long time, and it was a really, really big deal. So we're being reminded of that. We're being placed in history here, and you have to study and understand what's going on, but it is. It's like saying there's a famine. It's not that big boy famine. So you don't get confused. You don't think we're like still in the famine. And that's important for time frame, because that thing, it was ending when Abraham was starting, right? So that's important. That whole camel connection, all that stuff interlinks. The coolest thing about this study to me is how many of those little clues we get that interconnect with modern science and historical information. Like, the average person reading the Bible is not getting that. They're not seeing why that famine is important, or what the heck is going on with camels. I mean, none of that stuff really matters. And it doesn't have to. You still get the story of God and man and how it works. It's not a big deal. But for me, you know, for the studies that we're doing, it's really fascinating how these little pinpoint things are being dropped in there. It's sort of a continuation of how the beginning of Genesis worked, where we got all those clues. And it's fascinating to me. So we get that clue right off the bat. There's a famine now. It's not that first big famine of Abraham. It's later on, but there's a famine in the land. So now, what did Abraham do when that happened? He went down to Egypt, remember? Because Egypt has the Nile. And everything's built along the Nile. And even when the rest of the place that's more desert areas starts to get a famine, Egypt tends to have stuff. It tends to survive better. So people go into that fertile area of Egypt because it's always got the Nile, it's always flooding. Even when there's famine, it's pretty safe there. So that was what they were going to do. This to me is so cool because this is a pattern. So Abraham has a famine. He goes down into Egypt. Isaac has one. He's about to. He's going to get stopped. We'll talk about that in a second. And then later on, Joseph ends up in Egypt. There's this continual connection going on with Egypt. And what's fascinating about that historically is so many people have trouble with the history because how could they establish this or that in the Holy Land when Egypt's there? But if you study it more carefully, you discover that this area is kind of owned by Egypt for a lot of this time. But they don't really do a lot of stuff about that. Sometimes they come in there and have some wars, but usually they're just getting tribute from local kings and stuff like that. And it's really not the type of overlordship that you would imagine. And so these guys like Abraham and Isaac, and later on, the time, this is a perfect example of how things functioned in the time of the judges. You know, people are going to be scattered around in these tribes, and they're given these areas. They're not technically ruling, though. It's technically ruled by Egypt, but they don't care. So these guys are setting up shop. Eventually, there's a kingdom. That's why David's such a big deal. Saul and then David and Solomon's such a big deal. Because they don't have, until then, an actual kingdom, right? It's really just like a group of tribes. And that's why the 12 tribes are described like they are. And that's why they're given these areas like they are. It's basically the scattering of tribes. It's not... There would be a Pharaoh technically ruling that area during those tribal times, during the time of Judges. But they eventually gain enough power and take enough area that they can establish a real kingdom. And that's what that whole point was about, the whole establishment of the kingdom. But right now, we're way before that still, okay? But right now, we're getting these connections and we're continuing some of the things that we've dealt with before. Isaac went to Abimelech, the king of the Philistines, in Gerar. Then the Lord appeared to him and said, "Do not go down to Egypt. Live in the land of which I shall tell you. Dwell in this land, and I will be with you and bless you. For you and your descendants I give all these lands, and I will perform the oath which I swore to Abraham your father, and I will make your descendants multiply as the stars of heaven. I will give your descendants all these lands, and your seed all the nations of the earth shall be blessed, because Abraham obeyed my voice and kept my charge, my commandments, my statutes, and my laws." So God is coming directly to Isaac, and God is reaffirming what he told Abraham in the Abrahamic covenant. And he's stopping him from going to Egypt. I'm gonna have to do more research later on about the 40 years that when the Hebrews left Egypt, they zigzagged around for 40 years. But I am convinced that God is doing such amazing stuff, and that we just have hints. Like, don't go down to Egypt. Why? Why was it okay to Abraham for Abraham to go down to Egypt, but Isaac can't go down to Egypt? Well, we probably have, and it's conjecture, honestly, but we probably have an answer. Abraham was going down to Egypt during an intermediate period, right? And probably he was going to deal with a Pharaoh who was going to be amenable to talking to him about whatever was going on, trying to get him as an ally, stuff like that, and not cause him any trouble, which is exactly what happened. He let him go, didn't cause him any trouble. More than likely, the Pharaoh by now is a completely different deal. We could be dealing with a completely different type of Pharaoh, completely different type of mindset, and he might just take Isaac's stuff and kill Isaac. So God is protecting him. During the time of the 40 years after the Hebrews leave with Moses, after they leave, and before they get into the Holy Land, they're doing this kind of zigzagging around. During that period of time, the Pharaohs are having a war in that region. I'm really convinced, and I'm going to have to do a whole lot more research to figure this out if this is right, but I'm convinced that, like, the Pharaoh will come over here to fight these guys, and so they'll duck over here. And then they'll go down here to fight, and they'll duck over here. It's like the Israelites are doing this through the desert for 40 years. And the reason it's 40 years, of course, there's a generational thing, and there's all these reasons that are you could explain that 40 years. But one of the reasons it's 40 years is because when the time that they enter in, when they cross over the river, they go to take Jericho and all that, the time when they enter into that land, the Pharaoh is changed into a Pharaoh who really doesn't care. He's got himself a Mitanni wife. That's who they were battling, is the Mitanni. It's a kingdom up there in like Syria. And they're battling in the area where everybody's zigzagging, you know. And I'm convinced that if I could spend enough time, I could track where they zigged and where the battle was, where they zagged and where the battle was. But they have to be out there, because by the time they go in, if they would have gone in immediately, let's say Moses and the guys left Egypt and charged straight into the Holy Land. If that would have happened, they would have been crushed immediately. Because the pharaohs that were on the throne in Egypt were very powerful military pharaohs. And the guys would have sent letters and said, hey, we're under attack. And they would have sent armies of chariots and everything else and crushed them, right? But if they zigzag for 40 years till a pharaoh's in charge with has a Mitanni queen and doesn't care about this land at all, it's a neutral zone between the two kingdoms that they don't monitor. Now they can get in there and do whatever they want. And this is just so insanely cool to me. Like, you have to study a lot of different stuff and put puzzle pieces together. But it's just so insanely cool to me. But that's probably why he tells him not to go to Egypt. Because he's thinking, I'm going to go to Egypt, just like Abraham did, right? And Joseph ends up, I mean, this is like the thing. Go to Egypt. They even do that. Remember when they're going to try to kill Jesus? They even go down to Egypt. Everybody's fleeing to Egypt all the time, right? So that's the thing. Flee to Egypt. So don't do that. Don't flee to Egypt. Stay where you're at. And it's probably because if you went to Egypt, it would have been a bad thing. So Isaac dwelt in Gerar. So what have we learned so far? Okay, we learned that Isaac truly is the son of promise, and he truly is the next patriarch. Because in the first few sentences, we've got the Lord speaking directly to him. We've got him dealing directly with a powerful king. And we've got him immediately listening to exactly what God said. It doesn't say, so Isaac went down to Egypt to check it out, decided it wasn't a good idea, and went back. It says, so Isaac dwelt in Gerar. He did exactly what God said, immediately. Okay? And the men of the place ask about his wife. Now, let's check this out. So she's my sister, he's going to say. Come on, Isaac. Okay, Abraham did this multiple times, right? So Isaac is such a, like, you know, son, you know, whatever you want to call that, like a chip off the old block or whatever, okay? And he's using that same thing about she's my sister, because he's afraid of them. She's so beautiful, he's afraid they're going to kill her and take her or whatever. Rebecca, right? Now, I don't know what's going on with these people and their hotness, okay? But Sarah, like Abraham, even when she was 90, he's lying about it. I don't know what is going on, okay, with these. I don't know how to compare this. I think, if you ask me theologically and spiritually, I believe that you know how we have these little echoes? Remember how we talked in the beginning about the line that came out of Seth, the genetics, if you will, of Eden, okay? And something is special about these people. And they're the people of God. And of course, they've spread out and done all kinds of things after the flood. But remember how Abraham lived very long and was still, you know, getting new wives in his like 140s or whatever, you know? They're not normal. And remember how he had to go back to get a wife from Isaac from their people? I really believe that there's something special. I don't know what it is, okay? I won't know until later. I'll tell you later on. We'll see each other, and I'll say, hey, come here, I want to show you. This is Rebecca. My goodness, what is going on with me? I don't know what it is. I would go out on a limb and suggest, you know how when the angels came and they went into Sodom, and the guys all lined up to try to go rape the angels? Yeah. Now, why would those guys try to break down the door and do that? I would proffer the concept that the angels were supernaturally attractive. That something about them was... Now, these guys aren't religious people, so they don't see that attractiveness as worship. They just see it as, like, super attractive. And they warp that into, like, a sexual deviant thing, right? I would say that there's... Because Adam and Eve were created to be immortal, that there's an echo in this lineage, in this family structure, of some type of extra attractiveness. To put it in like modern sci-fi terms, you know how vampires in modern sci-fi movies are like supernaturally attractive? Like everybody's just drawn to them and like really wants to be with them and they hypnotize you with their eyes. It's sort of like that, right? It's sort of like people that have sort of a longer life, sort of a deeper understanding of the cosmos. But there's something, and I'm offering this possible suggestion because they keep doing this, try to hide my wife because she's so beautiful thing. I really don't think that when you're dealing with a pharaoh or you're dealing with a king, that there's going to be a whole lot of beautiful women. They're going to have harems. There's a lot of beautiful women. You go through all this trouble, there's got to be a reason. So I believe that there's something about this family line that's making the men more powerful, is making them more leaders, better leaders, is making them more successful, giving them power to talk to people like pharaohs or kings as equals. And the women in this line are supernaturally attractive in some way because they're scared to death that someone's going to kill them and take her. And this is multiple times that's happened. So something like that, because that's what he says. She's my sister, because he thought, if she says this is his wife, the men of the place will kill him for Rebekah because she's so beautiful. Now it came to pass when they had been there a long time, Abimelech, king of the Philistines, looked through a window and saw there was Isaac showing endearment to Rebekah, his wife. So they're like off in a little corner somewhere, snuggled up, and not like a brother and sister, right? So Abimelech calls Isaac and says, quite obviously, she's your wife. How can you say she's my sister? And Isaac explains, because I said, lest I die on account of her. And Abimelech says, what have you done to us? One of the people might have lain with your wife. You would have brought guilt on us. So Abimelech charges all his people, he who touches this man or his wife shall be put to death. Now, this is another thing. Why is Abimelech the king? Now, Isaac is a guy who's getting ready to sow in the land and become successful like his father. But they live in tents. Why is Abimelech worried about these guys? You know, why is that? I believe that there's something about these people that is showing on them. I don't know what it looks like, you know, but it, you know, represented in ancient art, you know, medieval art by halo, right? There's something on these people, whether it's their attitude, whether it's their connection of God, whether it's the legend surrounding them, whatever it is, there's something about them. When you talk to Isaac or you look at Rebekah, you're like, something is different about these people. I don't know if they're taller. I don't know if they're, you know, have some kind of glow about them. I know that Isaac just spoke to God, and so did Abraham. And remember what happened to Moses when he came down from speaking to God, right? He looked different. You can glow, you can get white hair. Stuff can happen to you when you deal directly with God. And they're dealing directly with God. Abraham and Isaac are dealing directly with God all the time. So maybe there's just this latent godness about them, like a glow in a way. I don't know. I don't know what it is. But there has to be a reason that all these people are so scared. If anybody, he's like mad at him, not because he wants Rebekah. He's mad at him because if we accidentally did something with Rebekah, we would be in trouble. So he gets it. He gets the God thing, right? So he puts out an immediate order to everybody. If anybody touches this man or his wife, I'm going to kill them myself before we get a chance for God to be mad at us. So something's going on. Meanwhile, Isaac, much like Abraham hanging out under the trees, okay, Isaac sowed in the land and reaped in the same year 100-fold, and the Lord blessed him. And the man began to prosper and continued prospering until he became very prosperous. He had possessions of flocks and herds and great number of servants, and the Philistines envied him. Now they had stopped up the wells of his father's servant, the father's servants had dug in the days of Abraham, and they had filled them with earth. And Abimelech said to Isaac, "Go away from us, you are much mightier than we." Why? "Go away from us, for you are much mightier than we." I thought it just said he like had some crops and stuff. What is going on? Either he's got an army, like weapons, armor, fully trained army, that's scary, or something about his godliness is creating that feeling. So Isaac departs. Now look what Isaac does. So Isaac is a man of peace, right? He departs from there and pitches his tent in the valley of Gerar and dwells there. And he's digging wells, the wells that they had Abraham had done. He's digging them back up. The Philistines stopped them up after the death of Abraham. So he's digging them back up. Isaac's servants dug in the valley. They found a well of running water there. The herdsmen of Gerar quarreled with Isaac's herdsmen, saying, "The water is ours." So he calls the name of the well Esek because they quarreled with him. Then he digs another well, and they quarrel over that one. So he calls his name Sitnah, and he moved from there to dig another well, and they didn't quarrel over that one. So he calls its name Rehoboth because he said, "For now the Lord has made room for us, and we shall be fruitful in the land." So it's very strange. A king is telling him, go away from us because you're mightier than us. But then he keeps moving to dig wells because he's quarreling with herdsmen. It's a very strange situation. So he went up from there to Beersheba. And the Lord appeared to him the same night and said, "I am the God of your father Abraham. Do not fear, for I am with you. I will bless you, multiply your descendants for my servant Abraham's sake." So he built an altar there and called on the name of the Lord, and he pitched his tent there, and Isaac's servants dug a well. They're digging wells everywhere. So he's once again communicating directly with God. Then Abimelech came to him from Gerar with Ahuzath, one of his friends, and Phicol, the commander of his army. And Isaac said to them, "Why have you come to me since you hate me and have sent me away from you?" And they said, "We have certainly seen that the Lord is with you." So we said, "Let there now be an oath between us, between you and us, and let us make a covenant with you, that you will do us no harm, since we have not touched you, and since we have done nothing to you but good, and have sent you away in peace. You are now the blessed of the Lord." So he made a feast, and they ate and drank. Then they arose early in the morning and swore an oath with one another, and Isaac sent them away, and they departed from him in peace. I really need a time machine. I need to be back there. I'll just tend to flocks or something. I'll be one of those servant guys. But I need to figure out what is going on. Something about Isaac and Abraham and everybody, it just carries with it so much power. Perhaps because we don't need to know, and we don't know the mind of Abimelech, right? God does. Perhaps Abimelech's had dreams that God is Isaac's God's chosen one. Perhaps he's had omens told, you know, seen things or heard things. Perhaps the history of Abraham and Isaac has reached him, and he's studied it, and he understands that this is the person. Maybe Isaac's just doing things in a certain godly way, and things are just happening that are like magical, like a bunch of crops are just awesome, and the crops over here are not. And he's just like, God is really blessing this guy nonstop. And Isaac's totally cool. He doesn't do anything weird. He doesn't fight him. It's like they have dinner. They make an oath, and now they're going to live in peace. It came to pass that same day that Isaac's servants came and told him about the well they had dug, and said to him, "We have found water." So he called it Sheba, and therefore the name of the city is Beersheba to this day. Now this is mostly historical, and it's mostly putting down wells, because when you go archaeologically and dig up these sites, there's a base of a well usually. It's usually the well that's the point. The point of Jericho was a very big, very ancient well. you need water. This is a lot of desert, right? You got a lot of crops. You need water. So the wells that they're talking about are significant wells. And they're doing them all over the place. And wherever they're doing them, they're setting up names and they're calling them stuff. And you can find reference to those things and find towns that have those names in them still. And Beersheba is a place. I mean, their archaeologists are working there now. So mostly we're getting some targeted evidence of the reality of all this. But we're also getting this feeling of who Isaac is, the strength that he's portraying through the Lord. And we're getting him listening to God and staying there. So this is the second of the great patriarchs that lived on this land as God has given them. So this is setting up the historical Israel. Okay. But it's this last one that's really like the thing that we can all identify with. It says, when Esau was 40, remember Esau, right? Sold his birthright for some stew. Now, when Esau was 40, he took his wives, Judith, the daughter of Beeri the Hittite, and Basemath, the daughter of Elon the Hittite. And they, listen to this, and they were a grief of mind to Isaac and Rebekah. That's how the New King James puts it. They were a grief of mind. These are your shady relatives that will not leave you alone. Okay? This is the people that keep asking for stuff. Can I put my camper in your yard or whatever, right? This is these people, right? Now, it's interesting who Esau marries. Hittites. Now, Hittites are a pretty significant group. They are in the north. They have a kingdom, and it's quite powerful at several points of time. But do you remember where Isaac's wife came from? Right? They specifically went and specifically got a specific woman from a specific area to maintain the solid nature of this historical thing, the way this genetics or this family or the belief in God or whatever it is, the structure had to be maintained. But this is not happening with Esau. Esau is not really on the right track. He's not really paying attention the same way. And he's not being taken care of the same way. He's getting a couple wives, both Hittites. So he's just, they're probably rich and powerful still, but he's way off of the chart. I don't know what kind of grief he was to Isaac and Rebekah, but he's like the black sheep of the family. He's like the bad seed, okay? And we'll learn more about that, but we can continue to think about what that might look like. But remember that Jacob has already got, part one, from Esau. And he's going to need to get more blessings, and he's going to need to get part two. We have to have the reason for this couple chapters here at the beginning of the second half of Genesis, there has to be a firm lineage. Abraham started it, and Isaac is the firm lineage because Isaac was the child of promise. Sarah had Isaac when she was very old. He was going to sacrifice him, all that stuff. So Isaac is the focal point of the next step. But Isaac's got a couple kids, and they're twins, which means that's dicey. So we have to have a way to get a significant figure. There has to be the next patriarch. And that's why Esau's messing everything up all the time. Right? He's not the one. Even though he's the older son, and tradition is going to tell Isaac he has to give everything to Esau, that's not what God's want to do. That's not what Jacob wants to do. Right? God's going to arrange it. Just like Saul was the first king, but not really. David was, right? We'd like to have Saul because Saul's this really great leader, and he's really loved by everybody, and he's tall and handsome, and he's awesome. We'd love to have him as the king, not the not the kind of pretty boy harp playing kid. But that's not God's deal. God needs people that have his heart, where his will and their will are aligning, where they could be plugged in. And as we know from our lives and from everything we've ever studied, it doesn't, you know, God is not about a particular look or a particular thing. He'll use different people, including people that make no sense to anyone. Like, you know, a prostitute in a wall at Jericho or whatever. He will use people that make no, that it doesn't make any sense to anybody to continue this line. And it is Isaac that's rock solid, and everything that we've seen from him has been rock solid. And now there has to be a Jacob. And Jacob has to be in position. He needs every type of blessing and every type of birthright he can get. Because he has to be, everything has to be focused into him. And so, as we continue into Genesis 27, we're going to see how that all plays out. Jacob's already, you know, got his birthright for some stew. But now he really needs the blessing. He needs to be the official continuation. And it's not supposed to be like that. Esau's there. He's present. He's older, you know, not by long, but he's older. And he's a serious contender for this, right? So there has to be a twist that makes it where Jacob is the one. Now, this is going to bring up questions in our life. And the questions that continue to pop up is, how much do we have to do with it? What I mean, and this is, we'll finish with this, is a deep philosophical and theological concept. But the argument for all of time, from Adam and Eve all the way up through you know, Calvin and Wesley, the argument is, how much do we have to do with it? Because there's a conflict in the nature of humanity. And the conflict is, we have an almighty sovereign God. He knows us before we're born. He knows the deal. He has a plan. But we also have free will. We can also make decisions. And those decisions can do crazy things. They don't alter God. God doesn't get altered by us. But they do create weird offshoots sometime. And a perfect example is Ishmael, right? Abraham and Sarah exercise their free will in, you know, in not in alignment with God's will, and create an entire thing. And, you know, Jacob is going to do some stuff to kind of make this thing come together, right? Now, so how much is it? How, you know, if we take the birthright, if we take the blessing, I mean, God made us to be that person to do that. So how does that work? And this is a real, one of the biggest of all theological questions. How much do we have to play, you know, in that? If God says, I need you to go over there, and you go over there, and you, and then whole, you know, island nation comes to Christ, right? What if you say no? You know, can you? In some cases, he'll put you there anyway. For more on that, you know, I don't know if whale is the proper, you know, the actual proper animal, but it probably wasn't technically a whale. It was probably something else that was a very, very large fish. I've actually seen a picture of a whale shark with a diver going into its mouth, which is pretty impressive. But anyway, I think he was trying to prove that there's stuff out there that you can actually get swallowed by. But anyway, the point is, sometimes you're like, I'm going this way. And he's like, no, you're not. You're going that way. I'm going to spit you back out over here. So to me, this is absolutely fascinating. Like the concept of our part in this. And this is the eternal argument, right? Between, you know, the whole idea of how we come to Christ. You know, do we have a say in that? The whole idea about election, you know, there's this idea, the doctrine of election, where God's chosen us to be saved and be with him before we're ever born, which would tend to indicate we don't have an option, right? I would argue that it doesn't actually mean that, that we still have an option. He just is timeless and knows what we're going to choose, basically. So it's kind of like a circular logic thing where God knows what you have free will, but he knows what you're going to do. He's not making you do it, right? So this is real. That's really complicated. Yes, ma'am.
Well, and you wonder when Isaac went out and got these two creepy wives, why didn't Jacob do that? You know, Jacob stuck with the family.
You mean Esau?
Esau, yeah.
Esau went out and got the creepy wives. And Jacob went and got back to his relatives to get a wife.
Yeah.
To keep that.
And that's exactly what has to happen. It's like it's the same thing that we have with Isaac. So, but you've got this. My point is, there's a twist in the next chapter, and we'll get to it next week. But I want to have you pre-think about this concept. So, if let's say that you took a blessing, like you just arranged it to get blessed. Because that reads as shady, right? But is it? Or did God make you like you are? Does God need you to do that weird thing? You know what I mean? Like, does he need you to act like this at some particular point in time? You know, I think back about my youth, and there were all kinds of bad things and weird stuff. I think about those things plugging into now and being meaningful, because they've been, I'm reassessing them now, and they become more meaningful. You had this break away from God, or this thing happened that was a bad thing, but then it made you a better person in the long run. How does it all work? Are we applying our will? You know, take a minister who was an alcoholic. Okay, and now he's running a powerful alcoholic ministry where he's helping thousands and thousands of people, you know, that have trouble. And he had this horrible, like, beat your wife, go to jail for burning down a bar life before that, right? But he's not effective in the position that God has him in without that. You don't go to talk to the biker alcoholic guys if you never were, because they don't listen. You have to be a pirate to minister to the pirates. So how does that work? Because you're like, no, you know, you're like, you want to be with God from day one your whole life and spend your whole life and all of eternity with God. That would be awesome. But that's not the way it plays out for most people, for a lot of people. You know, I think about Rihanna's cousin who, like, we have entire teams praying for, right? I think about how awesome he's going to be if he becomes a believer and everything like that, because he's got a lot of skills and characteristics that make him a strong, wonderful person. And if those were applied the right direction, it would be a very big deal. And there's a lot of people that he could help. He may never do that. There, we may never see him again, right? Or we might, you know. And it's just this whole concept of sovereign God, free will thing is just so amazing to me. I mean, I'm not hurt by it. I'm blown away by how complex it is. Because God has got people making decisions, and they're making wrong ones that turn into good things. It's just bizarre, you know. And I'm just curious, because you've got this this idea, you know. If God makes you, what is it about Jacob? Because God knows, okay, God knows Jacob's the next one. He's known that from the beginning, before there was an Abraham. He knew Jacob. So Jacob is the next in line. But Isaac doesn't know that. And Isaac's kind of a pawn in this game in a way. But it's Jacob that is going to be the one. He's going to be the father of the tribes of Israel. He's going to be the way everybody ends up in Egypt and then comes out of Egypt. I mean, all of this stuff is built upon Jacob. And the things that he does, as we study the next few chapters, we're studying Jacob, and Jacob is a fascinating character. Now, we remember Jacob as the old guy who loved his son who was in Egypt, and Joseph was in Egypt, and we remember that whole story of their reconciliation. But the young Jacob is crazy. There's a lot of wild stuff going on with Jacob, you know? And we know God's behind that. So what does that all mean? What does that look like? The next chapter we get to next week is really going to stretch our understanding of how free will and God work. Because we've got to have Jacob as the next patriarch. He's got to establish the 12 tribes of Israel. That's like the core of everything. But the way Jacob gets away, and what's up with the blessing? I mean, how can you get it under false pretenses or whatever and still have it mean something? I mean, the blessing is, it's in this story that we're going to study next time, and I just want everybody to think about this concept for a week. But as we get to this part, the idea of this blessing, it seems to be almost like a physical thing, right? Mm-hmm. It's like the blessing is a, you know, an iPhone, and if I can get you to hand it to me, I'm good, or whatever. It's not like, oh, I can figure out later and take it back or something. That's very strange to me. And I think it's because the power, this is my theological ramification comment on that. I think it's because the power of God is so concentrated at this point. What I mean by that is that we have these single like men of God. We have like Abraham and then Isaac. And then Jacob. And it's so concentrated. I mean, now we have millions of preachers and millions of missionaries and millions of people of God worldwide. I mean, it's, God's power is infinite. Therefore, infinite divided by 10,000 is still infinite. Okay. But the point is that it's all concentrated in these people. And so to me, it's like the blessing is like such a big deal. It's carrying something almost tangible with it. It's like you're going to become, it's sort of like if a king declares this person to be the next king and then dies. It's like that declaration sticks, right? It's sort of like that. You're going to be blessed and you're going to be declared to be the heir of it, all this. And that includes this whole thing of land that God's promised us. And to me, that's just mind-boggling, like the way it all works. We'll get into that next time, but just think about this idea as you read that and get ready for next week, this idea of the blessing and this idea of the birthright and this idea of how it gets exchanged and all the weird stuff that happens throughout this book. I mean, how strange some things are, you know, and this is just another example of how weird the plan can be. Mm-hmm. And to me, it's a primary example. For the whole Bible, this is sort of a primary example. Sort of like Peter becoming the head of the church, right? After he's the denier. He's the one who denies Christ. So how does that work? And Christ, but he's been chosen to be this guy. And so that's the way it is. And there's a reason behind that. It's like David. David makes all these mistakes and does all this weird, shady stuff. But he's the chosen one. It's like this. There's this connection somewhere in there of free will and God, and it's just shocking. I mean, it's like God's plans being unveiled, and it almost has to have weird stuff in it. Does that make sense? It's like David and Bathsheba. So David does this completely shady thing, right? Sees this girl, wants her, sleeps with her, gets her husband killed. I mean, complete shady, bad stuff. And the kid that they have out of that, God takes because he's like, you don't get this. This is your punishment, and breaks his heart and destroys him. But it's Bathsheba that's the mother of Solomon. She has to be there. It has to work like that. Even though it's crazy and shady and weird, it has to be like that. It's like the stuff that happened in the cave with Lot. It's like if that weird, shady stuff in the cave didn't happen with Lot, we wouldn't have had Ruth or whatever, right? Mm-hmm. It's like it has to happen. This is just like a little sidetrack for me. Like my mind is blown by the weirdness that gets in the mix, like the Lot thing and the David thing and how Because this, you know what? I'll finish with this. This is my primary realistic proof of the Bible. Here's what I mean. If you were writing a fake story about the history of a culture to try to make it look good, none of this weirdness would be there. You would write the story of how David was this awesome hero guy, never made any mistakes, because he's King David. He's the King David, right? And Jesus is the new David. I mean, this is the King David. It would be this glowing, perfect story. Nobody escapes in the Bible without humanity jacking them up. Peter is denying Christ. David is killing people's husbands. I mean, everybody has humanity in their way. Abraham's making mistakes. Jacob's going to do a whole goat skin, you know, magic show next chapter. I mean, it's like everybody is jacked up. And the reason that's so important to me, because first of all, hello, we're all jacked up, right? You know, raise your hand if you've been perfect since day one. Okay, no one should be raising their hand. You know, maybe Andy, but other than that, I mean, the bottom line is we all have that stuff. We all have that weird thing we did whenever, or that bad thing we did and we had to seek forgiveness for, or whatever it is. And so, but if you were writing that, if you were faking that book, this would be, you know, what happens when people wrote things in history to try to make themselves look good? They wrote those, like the big stelas we talk about, that big, those big giant stone things that tell the story of a king or what he did. It's the glorified version of the perfection of how awesome we are. There would never be weird, crazy things happening in caves. You would just delete all that, right? So for me, the continual humanity and weirdness, if you will, of the Bible is proof that it's real. I mean, I don't need more proof than the Spirit in me telling me that. But to me, realistically, if I was making a literature argument, a historical literature argument with somebody, like an atheist guy or whatever, literature guy, I would say it doesn't make any sense to have all the bad stuff if you're trying to make yourself look good, if you're like a Jew that wants to make Jews look good, or a Christian that wants to make Christians look good, it doesn't make any sense. It doesn't. To put all that stuff in there. And it's not one author. If it was one author, you could argue as a literary person, you could argue that was a technique that an author developed. Oh, let's put shady stuff in there because that'll be more believable. But it's not one author. It's dozens of major authors. And some of these people are not the kind of people that would, you know, make something up. People like Paul are writing this stuff, and they're just like lasers, right? They're not going to do anything. But continuously, there's these flaws in these human beings. It's the overview. It makes the entire thing mean more to us, more important and more informative for us in our lives, because we're not perfect. And there's like nobody in there that's perfect. I mean, there's some pretty, I mean, Josh was pretty cool. There's some pretty close to perfect individuals, but not anybody is perfect. And you have the biggest, most powerful individuals are all kinds of jacked up, man. They make huge mistakes. You know, David and Abraham are just probably the two biggest figures, and they make massive mistakes. And I think that if it was glossed over or it was fake, none of that would exist. It would be like this glorified story of these kings. Like if you read the history of the kings of blah, 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 it's all this glory. It's like this King Arthur stuff. It's all these glorified stories of all this awesome stuff or whatever. And it's just not like that. And the next chapter is the perfect example. Because literally the father of the 12 tribes is about to get all kinds of shady. Okay? And it's the ultimate example of how God works with our flaws. Of how God takes people that have problems, that have issues, that make mistakes. He can build anything. He's God. He can build an empire on the back of a complete loser. I mean, he can't. That's his deal. He's God. which is a really good news for us, right? Because he'll take anything and work with it. You know, you can be the dull half a scissor at the back of the drawer, and he'll still figure something out. You know? So anyway, I just love it. And so anyway, now we're in the Isaac story. We got the Jacob and Esau thing happening. We're going to move into Jacob pretty quick. But next time, we're in Genesis 27, and Jacob's going to get his blessing one way or the other. Anybody have any comments or questions about anything right now?
I think some of the stuff in the Bible is so crazy when you read it, you know, some of the stories. But I think that's why along the way God has put some stuff out there you can't deny. Like, I mean, you can't deny the pyramids. I mean, they are there, and they're, you know, all these years old. And it kind of lets you know, wow, all this other stuff might have a chance of being true too, because they built these rock stone pyramids thousands of years ago, and there they are. Kind of hard to deny a pyramid, you know, that's way up there.
Now you're making me wonder if God planted Bathsheba.
Yeah, that's what I'm trying to say. You know, he's in charge. He gets the situation's arranged. She's there. But David still has a choice. How does it work? I mean, we can't know the mind of God, but like, I'll give you an example. Let's say David looked down there and said, wow, and then said, okay, no, back to my prayers, right? And he didn't do anything shady. Well, then what would happen? More than likely, Uriah the Hittite would die in battle. He would end up marrying her anyway and having Solomon.
Exactly.
Right? God's in charge, but you still are in the mix with these decisions. And sometimes, a lot of times, you make the wrong one. I mean, I've made most of my life, the good things in my life have been based on really bad decisions. Like, I made a bad decision to do something that made no sense at the time. And then later on, that became a very big, important thing that I was supposed to have done, even though if I would have known what I know now, I would have never done it. Mm-hmm. Right? It's like God specifically arranges those pieces. You get to make that decision, and he's got like 5,000 pathways doing this, and you can do what you want, but you're going to end up, something's going to happen over here. Mm-hmm. You know, if there's that person that you're supposed to minister to in the park at this particular time over here that saves their whole family, that's got to happen no matter how you get there. Yeah. Right? So, and to me, it's part of God's infinite quality that we can't comprehend because it's infinite and we're finite, so we can't really understand the concept of infinite. But in my mind, there could be infinite paths. Like, you get to a decision, it goes like this. You get to a decision, it goes like that. You get to a decision, it goes like that. There could be a billion, billion, billion paths, but God could see them all, mm-hmm, because he's infinite. We can't. All we can see is, I got to pay this bill or whatever it is, or dodge the traffic problem. But God's got every single thing. I mean, think about the zoo a day or two ago. Every single car in the parking lot, give or take, was destroyed, right? Every single one of those is part of a plan that God has for those people's lives. Like, something is going on. Somebody needed, like, a lot of people in a place need to lose a lot of cars. I don't know why. Okay, but there's all these echoes of that. I don't even know all the stories, but I guarantee you there's story after story after story about things that happen based on that. It's this big, giant focal point. But suddenly, like, 1,000 cars are completely destroyed at one time. Like, randomly. It's, you know, what did it do? I mean, I'm sure it did all kinds of things. What if one of the guys that was there at the zoo, you know, his car got destroyed? So he calls his brother, he's kind of estranged from, can you give me a ride to work? My car's annihilated. They don't even have any replacement cars right now. They're driving to work, and he ministers to him in the car, and he gets saved. You know, things like that. I'd be willing to bet, and I can't interview everyone for the next 100 years that had anything to do with that car thing, but I'd be willing to bet that that kind of stuff is just going echoing out in all directions. You know, you were going to be in a car, and you were going to hit this person and kill them, but now you don't have that car. So you're calling into work, and they make it across the street. This is what I do for fun late at night. Like, think about the complexity of God's plan. Like, how big it is. Just the people that you know, it's like this infinite thing. But then you start thinking about the world. Like, things like everybody at the mall. Every single one of those people has got something going on, like some path. And you're just, like, thousands. It's mind-boggling. Like, think about a sports game. 40,000 people in attendance at this football game or whatever. All 40,000 people got there somehow in some way, and every single thing is relatable. And only God can see that. But it just blows my mind. Anyway, I wanted to bring that up as the last subject of how that all works, because when you read the next section, if you read it lightly, you're like, this is just dumb, right? How could this possibly be? Or you read it with a bad twist to it, like, oh, you can just take power, right? I mean, there's all these issues that come up from chapter 27, which aren't problems that Isaac had, right? Isaac seems to be doing everything God says and doing everything smoothly. Everything seems to make sense. And Esau's bugging him, you know, and all of that. Like, he's like, you know, him and Esau and his wives coming in the extra, they're in the extra bedroom, making noise, they trash the pool house or whatever. It's just like crazy. And Rebecca's like, Isaac, do not let Esau come over here anymore. And he's like, I have to. He's my son. He's my firstborn son. And it's just like the complexity of all that. It blows my mind. And I mean, I love it so much. And it's so real, because people do that. People make these big mistakes, or they go and do these things that aren't exactly, you know, they're not exactly Christ-like when they do them, and then it turns into something important, you know. Because God's sovereign. If he wasn't, that would all be just horrible, and it would spiral out of control, and all these bad things would come from it. But God will take anything, including a bad thing, and turn it into something good. He works all things to the good, you know. So anyway, we'll get to chapter 27, and we'll see what Isaac and Jacob and everybody has to do next time with this blessing. But we can pray. Heavenly Father, that was quick. Thank you so much for this time, we just love being in the Word so much and talking about it so much that it just flies. Thank you. Thank you, thank you. Thank you for your Word. Thank you for the wisdom that we get from it. Thank you for the glimpse into your heart and your mind that can help us learn more about ourselves. And just please be in our lives. Be with us. Align our wills and our hearts to yours. Have your way with us. Protect everyone here. Protect their homes and their finances and their families. Just make their lives rock solid so that they can be used as a sharp tool from your drawer to do what it is you need done. Your kingdom is all that we care about. Your glory in your name is why we're here. We want to know more of you and have more of you in our lives. Just bless us with that. Be closer to us every day. Keep everyone here safe till we see them again. Keep everyone safe from all the crazy weather, and do your will. Your will be done with all these things. And we pray this in the mighty name of Jesus. Amen. Thank you.